Hello and welcome to another Linguistics Career Cast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. Abby Bayounimi is a linguist with 10 plus years of experience leading UX research and content initiatives across multiple industries, working for organizations such as Google, Calendly, Medtronic, Princeton University, and the nonprofit New Public. She is a contributing writer on the intersection of UX and linguistics for Code Like a Girl and has published a number of articles at Medium. She is a self-professed word nerd and loves the Oxford comma. Topics discussed include UX research, Hispanic linguistics, networking, social media, content moderation, implicature, resumes, and LinkedIn. Links to Abby's LinkedIn and other resources are in the show notes. My guest today is Abby, and I would like to thank you, Abby, for taking the time to talk with me about your very interesting career and how you ended up where you are today.
Well, awesome. Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
So first question, as I ask everybody, is how did you find out about linguistics and decide that that was something you were actually going to go to school for?
Yeah, so I started college thinking I wanted to be either a medical engineer or a medical doctor.
Oh, wow.
And okay. Yeah, and I kind of changed course. I mean, your undergrad is supposed to be for exploration, right? Uh-huh. And I decided that maybe I didn't want to do that. Maybe I wanted to be a software developer, an engineer, because that's what my mom did. And she was like, you're really good at language. You should do that. And I was like minoring in Spanish at the time. Uh-huh. And I was in a class at 8 o'clock in the morning trying to write some code in Java to draw a square. And I couldn't get the two lines to close. And I was like, oh my God, I'm not good at this. I cannot deal with the level of like detail and scrutiny involved in writing code. I can't do this. And so I was like, I'm going to major in Spanish. I have to pick something. And as part of the Spanish major, we had to take Introduction to Hispanic Linguistics. And I just fell in love with linguistics in that class.
Oh God, that's really funny. I'm what a choice between like, do I want to do linguistics or do I want to do programming? That's amazing. And also making the leap from like, I could be a doctor or I could do these two other things, which seem wildly unrelated, but not really. I mean, there are other folks that I've talked to who have programming as either a background or an adjacency to linguistics, because there is a lot of crossover there. You know, there's so much about linguistics that is architecture, right?
Yeah.
Like classifying things, putting things into taxonomies. And I think that is one of the skills you learn as a linguist that's really helpful later on, no matter what kind of job you get. Just this idea that you can take language and classify it in ways that most people do not think about when they're thinking about just language in general.
Totally. And I used to say that because I really liked algebra, I was kind of a weirdo. And I was like, this is like algebra, but for words.
Yeah, totally. That's a great way to think about it. Oh, very, very cool. Okay. So did you do an undergraduate degree in linguistics or was that later?
Yeah, no, I did. I ended up majoring in Spanish studies with a focus on Hispanic linguistics.
Okay, cool. And then you were like, oh, I could do more.
Yeah. So I took a longer time to finish my bachelor's degree because I had some family health issues that I was dealing with. And I sort of took a break from my undergrad. And this is where the medical interest comes in. I got a degree in veterinary technology.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, so I worked as a vet tech, a certified veterinary technician for a while. And there's kind of a ceiling as to, you know, how much you can learn and do as a vet tech. And I didn't want to be a veterinarian because I didn't like the idea of being responsible for surgeries. I didn't want to do surgery on pets. I just was like, if they die, it would wreck me. And so then I was like, okay, I don't want to stop learning. And I was meeting with who would then become my master's advisor, who was the person who taught my Intro to Hispanic Linguistics course. He's so strange and I loved him so much. I was just chatting with him and I was like, you know, I got to finish my degree. I don't know what I'm going to do. And he was like, well, you could just go to grad school. And I was like, oh, I suppose I could. And so I applied to both nurse practitioner programs because it's like, I don't know what to pick. I love linguistics. I love medicine. What do I do? And I got waitlisted on the nurse practitioner program and I got accepted to the linguistics program. And so I was like, well, decision made.
That's amazing. Okay. Great. So your choice was made for you.
Yeah.
How fortuitous. That's cool. When you started the linguistics grad school, did you have any idea of where your specialty was going to be? Or were you just like, I'm in grad school. This is great.
I knew that I liked pragmatics and sociolinguistics. Uh-huh. I knew that I liked that, but I was so like, you mean I'm going to write a book by the end of this? Are you kidding me? So I was just kind of like, well, let's just take all of the classes that I need to take and see, you know, what happens. Cause I was like, I don't think I'm going to be able to write a book. Are you crazy? But yeah, I already knew I was interested in sociolinguistics and pragmatics.
So were you still working on Hispanic linguistics in addition to, okay. All right. Yeah. So those things were coming together as part of your grad school studies.
Yeah. I applied only to linguistics programs in departments of Spanish and Portuguese because I wanted to continue on in the Spanish language.
Okay, cool. And what did your dissertation end up being on?
My dissertation was the development of linguistic complexity and accuracy in second year Spanish students.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
That sounds like a lot of field work.
Yeah, I spent a whole year in a second year intermediate Spanish course at a small liberal arts college here in Minnesota.
Wow, very cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so from an outside perspective, it's like you're gathering all this real world knowledge. Like this is stuff that's immediately transferable to a career outside linguistics. But mm-hmm. were you thinking at that point that you were going to continue in academia, or were you even then looking outside?
Well, so I was really active on Twitter at the time. The linguist Twitter was amazing back then. And so I could kind of see the writing on the wall that there were, you know, very few faculty options available. Like people were just struggling to get interviews. There weren't that many jobs advertised. And, you know, I started thinking about my own quality of life. Like, where do I want to live? Do I want to move away from my family where I've put down roots? Is that an acceptable trade-off to me to continue teaching? I loved teaching. I loved being in the classroom. I loved the energy of being around students and the inspiration that they gave me. But it was just, I started thinking about, you know, all right, well, what do I want my life to look like? I started grad school a little bit later than most. So I wasn't like, you know, 4-year college degree, go right to grad school, graduate, and then, you know, you're 28 or 30 or whatever. I was in my 40s when I graduated. So, I was thinking more of those thoughts about like, what do I want the rest of my life to look like? And do I want to, you know, go wherever the wind takes me to have it?
So, I one thing I'm really interested in is what was the feeling like in your department as you were finishing your PhD? There seems to be a lot of wild variation amongst linguistics departments in the U.S. anyway, as to how much support they give people who are starting to look outside. Some are incredibly supportive and some are geared that way. I mean, Georgetown is the great example. Like that whole program is about careers outside of academia. And yet there are many that sort of pretend that careers outside of academia don't really exist. Mm-hmm. And if you say that that's what you want to do, they're like, no.
Yeah.
And, you know, the professors who are there have no experience. They've never done that.
Exactly.
So they don't really know how to support their students. So what was it like in Minnesota? Like, did they have support? Did they have programs? Were there people that you could talk to about this?
Not really. I mean, it was sort of a like, you should probably not tell your advisor.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
My master's, I had a different advisor for my master's versus my PhD.
Okay.
And my master's advisor, I was kind of talking to him about this, you know, in my master's, I was like, you know, I'm looking at the job postings available and there just aren't that many considering how many of us are in the programs. And he was like, oh, well, you know, you could just go be an administrator for a high school or a principal or something. And I was like, oh, okay. I mean, so he wasn't like negative about it, but like he just was very kind of hand wavy in the way that someone with no experience in that area would have. So like, it wasn't malicious in any way, shape or form. It was just like, you could do, you know, go teach at a high school or do whatever. But there was still this like overarching vibe, I guess, that you should probably, once you're in the dissertation stage, you should probably not tell your advisor if you're looking outside. Like, there was a person who did the PhD for fun in my department. And when they left on the, you know, alumni page or whatever, it just said business career. And that's it. Whereas everybody else had like assistant professor at blah, 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 or visiting assistant professor or, you know, associate professor once they were promoted. So there's just this vibe that like you don't talk about non-academic careers.
Yeah. How interesting. Wow. I think it's shifted somewhat.
I think so.
So the shift is slow. It's happening, which is good. And I wanted to clarify. So your experience is like 2015, right? Is that when you finish? Okay.
Yeah, just like 10 years ago.
10 years ago. Yeah, just to give people a feeling for when this is happening. And so not that long ago. And my experience is longer ago than that. And the feeling when I was finishing and not getting my PhD and not knowing that I wasn't going to go into academia because it just wasn't the right fit for me, it wasn't so much you didn't talk about it. It was a real culture of shame around not having a career. So I think it shifted from the culture of shame to more the culture of we just don't talk about it. Mm-hmm. So that's different. And I know that there are more departments now that are really coming to accept it and providing more support in small ways. So the shift is happening. It's not happening as fast as it needs to be because the job market for academics is just, I mean, non-existent at this point, given what's happening in the U.S. anyway with funding and how many universities just are like kind of getting rid of their humanities departments.
Yep.
It's really kind of crazy. And the, you know, the job market, so this is, we're talking in December of 2025, is insane at the moment for a lot of reasons, but there are still jobs available and there are jobs for linguists that are available. And we'll talk about some of that, but at least there are jobs like,
You
could work.
You can, but even then, it's not the same as, you know, if you got a tenure track position 10 years ago.
Right.
A friend of mine who was in a tenure track position, she was laid off. Her department was eliminated. And so, like, that's, you know, you might be able to find the job, but how long does it last? You know?
Exactly. Yeah. Those kind of lifelong tenure track jobs just don't exist anymore. And the conditions that you could get a job, even if you were starting, most people are sort of cobbling things together from adjunct positions and part-time positions. And it's just very, very difficult to survive, which is terrible because, you know, who's going to teach the next generation of kids, right?
Like, exactly.
How can you be a good, caring teacher when you are struggling to survive and you've got a huge overload of work and, you know,
you have the resources to provide the type of education that you want to provide.
Yeah. So it's very sad. But all of that is by way of saying for the people who are graduating, because there are thousands and thousands of people graduating with BAs and MAs and PhDs, for the employment for them looking to industry, there are places where you could go that you could use your skills that you've learned as a linguist. And in some cases, I mean, there are nonprofits and there are places where you could go that's, you can feel like maybe you're actually doing some good in the world. So I would love it if you could talk about sort of the winding path that you took once you finished your PhD.
Yeah.
How did you start your journey into industry? Like, what did you do as you were looking for that first job after you graduated?
Yeah. So I was actually working as a visiting professor when I graduated. So I was at an institution that I loved, but, you know, like a lot of places, they were just unsure of enrollment and if they'd be able to continue to employ me. So I started looking and around at the options. And I was really fortunate in that both my spouse and my mom worked in technology for many, many years. And my spouse is more of a support level person. And my mom was a developer and engineer, and then went into business analysis. And so she had a lot of connections in the technology world. And she was like, you know, there's this user experience role that you might be good at. They do research and, you know, that sort of thing. And And so she was, she offered to introduce me to folks that she knew who worked in user experience. So that was like, you know, a privilege that I had that a lot of folks aren't going to have. And so I started making connections through that. And then I also reached out to a friend of mine who was working in the fundraising and giving department at a local college. And she's just was super well connected and in women's groups and stuff. And so she offered to introduce me. Like, she blasted out an email to her contact list to help me get started meeting people in industry, in the user experience field, in technology in general. And so I started talking with people and having, you know, informational interviews. And at the same time, I was also doing a lot of like Google searching, like, what does a user experience researcher do? And, you know, I ended up finding Anna Marie Trester's Linguists Outside of the Academy series a long time ago. And I came across Nancy Frischberg's profile and her story. And that was really inspirational to me. She was describing her day to day. And I was like, you know, that sounds like fun, you know? So yeah. I think this might be a good fit for me. And so I just, you know, really dove into doing a lot of networking. Someone that I actually ended up working for a few years later, he told me that when you're transitioning, he's like, you have the skills needed to be really great at this job. It's just that you don't have the legibility on your resume of someone who has worked in the field. So getting that first job, he's like, that's going to be the hardest thing for you is to get the very first job in user experience research. And it was. But the networking paid off eventually. And I was put in touch with a guy who is a recruiter for user experience in the Twin Cities. And he helped me find my first position. So that's basically how I entered into industry. It was a lot of hard work, a lot of networking, a lot of waiting, a lot of dashed hopes when people were like, I might have a position for you. And then it just never worked out.
Right.
But then finally something did land.
Yeah. That sounds like the common experience, but you put in the work, right? And a lot of that work is long-term, right? Stuff that doesn't come back around immediately probably comes back around in the long term.
Yeah.
And the kind of networking that you were doing is the kind of networking that we always encourage people to do, which is just like get out there and make contacts, because you never know what thing is going to actually turn up the right contact for you. So following people on LinkedIn and joining groups and just looking at interesting folks. And as you said, doing informational interviews and just seeing who knows who. And it's work, like you said, it's a lot of hard work, but it will pay. In the end,
it does. And the guy that I mentioned who was saying that my first job would be the hardest one to get, like, I ended up working for him like 2 years later, and I worked with him for 5 years. So yeah, it's I always tell people when they come to me that networking is not an instant, like, you're going to get a job out of this, although sometimes that does happen, but it's more of a long game. You used to think of it as a long game.
Yeah, it totally is. And it's the long game that really pays off. The longer, I hate to say play it, but it's true. The longer you participate in it, let's say it that way. The longer you participate in this, the more payoff you're going to get. And I'm sure that you found that people that you were starting to network with way back when are probably still contacts for you and will continue to be contacts for you for the rest of your career. And you just never know when something's going to come up that really works out, or you refer people to them, or they're referring people to you. So
yeah, exactly.
Your own little solar system that just keeps going around and pays off.
Yeah. And one of the pieces of advice he gave me was, he keeps a spreadsheet of everybody he wants to stay in touch with.
Wow. That's amazing.
And then, and so like he will check it quarterly, monthly, whatever, and see who he hasn't contacted in a while. And he'll reach out to that person and just set up a call or a coffee or whatever, just to re-up that relationship. And then documents, you know, when was the last time I talked to that person? So he's like, I do that because I want to, you know, exactly what you were talking about. I want to make sure I keep myself front of mind for these folks and just keep that relationship going, you know. And it's usually really fun anyway. Like, there's a lot of really fun, kind, funny people in user experience and others, but this is my, you know, I'm in user experience. So that's what I know, but yeah, it's not, it's work, but it's enjoyable because you get to talk to smart, fun people, you know?
Yeah. And you learn stuff from them too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh boy, if I could only be that organized.
I know he told me to do that, and I can't keep up with it. But you know, props to him.
Amazing, yeah, that's fantastic. What would you say is, or maybe there are multiple answers here, of the stuff that you learned and used in your linguistics research in grad school, translated best into the kind of UX stuff that you've been doing?
Oh yeah, that's a great question. So because I've worked in a bunch of different fields, so I've worked in logistics, e-commerce, medical technology, medical devices, software as a service, big tech, and now I'm at a R&D tech nonprofit startup type of situation. Mm-hmm. I've used different skills at different companies based on what they did. And so, I would say the through line across all of that is the research skills that I gained in my PhD. So the ability to do interviews, write surveys, mm-hmm. analyze data, qualitative and quantitative, being able to tell that story. But my last two roles, so the one right before the one I currently have, and then this one, were way more directly related to my linguistics training than any other job that I've ever had. Because my job before last, I was on the emoji and expression team at Android at Google. And we are basically creating products that help people communicate and express themselves with other folks through their phones. So tech-mediated communication. And then my current role at New Public, I am helping build pro-social communication platforms. So all very directly related.
What does that mean, pro-social platforms?
So you can think of it kind of like an analog to social media, but not toxic.
Okay, that sounds great.
Yeah. So I'm basically teaching my team about turn-based conversation, for example.
Okay. Oh, okay, cool. Yes. Okay, now we're back in linguistics. Yeah. I get it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, neat. And what kind of environments are, so you said it was a nonprofit. What kind mm-hmm. of environments are these being developed for?
Well, my program, so there's New Public has two programs. One of them is called Roundabout, and they just actually launched their product. And that is kind of a social media platform, but it's for very localized communities to basically have a way to connect if they're not in person. So an online platform for communities to connect with one another. And then my program is Public Spaces Incubator, and we're partnering with a consortium of public media companies to reimagine what comment spaces essentially could look like on public media, like news or other such platforms.
Oh, that sounds really cool.
Yeah.
This is one place where I think linguists are so desperately needed, and yet I don't see that many of them there. I had spoken to a couple people who work in trust and safety, and there should be so many linguists in trust and safety when it comes to platforms, both public and private, because the vexed question of how do we moderate these spaces and how should they be, policed is really complicated, super, super complicated. And linguists are really, really good at understanding how public spaces operate for communication between people, right? Like engineers are great and all that, but they're not linguists, right? You have to be a linguist to understand how people actually use language to communicate.
Yep.
And I don't know. I feel like all of the places that run communications platforms should have just armies of linguists who are looking at this stuff and helping to develop the rules for it and helping to develop the enforcement mechanisms. It should just all be linguists.
Yeah, totally. I mean, introducing words like coded language and dog whistles and things like that to my team, understanding where large language models will not do a good job of moderating things. Like, for example, if the surface grammar is very polite, but the pragmatics below the mechanical grammar is very not polite, then, that's not something that an LLM can pick up because it doesn't have the same context, the same cultural context that a person would have when they're reading that, right?
So, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's been really interesting and like rewarding, I would say, to be able to pull on that knowledge base that I have from linguistics to be able to help educate my team and help them understand where you know, large language models, agentic AI would not be helpful for us or would maybe fall down when dealing with things like trust and safety and things like that. Mm-hmm. I totally agree that we should have more linguists in trust and safety. They tend to index more on social, other social sciences like psychology and things like that. But yeah, definitely people who understand the mechanics of language and how all of that works.
Yeah.
And definitely necessary.
And even just the basics. I mean, if you don't have a good grounding in things like, you know, Gricean rules, like you're not going to understand how people do conversations. Mm-hmm. Like you need to understand the basics of how conversations actually happen before you can start to make rules around what's allowable in a conversation. Because otherwise it's just, you know, like you're not going to get it.
Yeah. And then the understanding of how that changes based on where you are, your position in society is something that a lot of folks don't have. Like they, you know, read something and say, well, I find that insulting. And it's like, okay, but you're not a member of the group that would use it in this way. So of course you think it's insulting, or of course you think it's fine. I've been talking with the engineers on my team about how the different surface level grammar structures can be deceiving, and how large language models can't necessarily pick up on implicatures or their pragmatic intent underneath the surface level grammar. You know, we've had some examples in some of our product testing where people say things that on the surface they look really polite, but actually quite rude pragmatically, and the large language model isn't going to pick that up. And so, you know, having those conversations and educating them about how, you know, something that you may see and think is fine is actually not. It's coded language for something quite rude or insulting, or, you know, something that you find upsetting or insulting is actually, you know, appropriate for a different social context. So what is that, you know, how does the grammar intersect with who you are as a person and your position in society is something that I've been talking a lot about with my team.
Yeah. And two, I think there's a lot of cultural stuff that happens so fast these days that obviously nothing that's automated like a large language model could possibly pick up on, because these sorts of things that, like you were talking about, implicatures, come up so fast and it changes from day to day that you need human beings who are like attuned to what's going on culturally in the world to like see it happening and be able to say, oh no, like yesterday that was okay and today it's not, and we can't allow this anymore.
Yeah, I actually just read a paper for work from Kendra Calhoun and Alexia Fawcett called "They Edited Out Her NipNops: Linguistic Innovation as Textual Censorship Avoidance" on TikTok. That's exactly the thing. Like, people figure out what the algorithm is penalizing them for, and they go around it. So, you know, the authors outline these different structural processes that people use, whether they know about it or not, to get around these algorithmic censorship or guidelines. And you can't, like, as soon as you update the prompt or the model or whatever to get around that and like catch these things, they've changed it already because they figured out what you're doing.
So it's, I mean, this is the sort of thing that can never be automated. Like you just have to have people there who are going to be doing this sort of stuff. So anyway, so there's going to be jobs for linguists, I think, doing this. That's great. So you've been doing, so most of your work seems to be in doing this kind of research. What kinds of stuff has been like different and most interesting? Like, have there been places where there's been a steep learning curve for you in the different jobs that you've had?
Not really. I would say actually the biggest learning curve was, and it really wasn't that big, just because, like I said, I was privileged to have family members that worked in tech. And so they could help me with some of the translation stuff. But I think the hardest thing for me was translating my CV into a resume and trying to figure out, like, what do hiring managers care about? And being able to speak the language, the business language, right? So that translation exercise was kind of difficult. But like I said, I was fortunate enough to have people available to have them help me do that translation work. I know that's not the case for a lot of folks. So I try to be that person if they come to me and I have bandwidth. But I think that's the hardest thing, is just that translation exercise. And, you know, I'm sorry, but people don't in the industry don't really care about your publications for the most part. And that's really painful to take those off of your resume.
Yeah, no, but for sure. I know it's a whole different world when you're looking at things, and there are just a lot of different places where you can tweak it. And this is something mm-hmm. else that I think is good to know as you're going into the industry world too, is that it's good to be able to tweak what you have, right?
Yeah.
Because you're probably going to have to tweak your resume maybe for every single job that you apply for, mm-hmm. because they're looking for something that's slightly different. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Like, you might mm-hmm. have to tweak it, you know, 5 times in a month if you're applying for 5 different jobs.
Yeah.
And it's fine. It's fine to do that. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with your resume. It just means they're, you know, you just have to use a different buzzword or whatever it is that company might be looking for.
And exactly.
It's just an ongoing thing. It's fine.
Yeah. I mean, I like to tell people that it's audience design, basically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, who is your audience? Who are you trying to get to understand this document? So, like, we do that all the time as academics. Like, we're mm-hmm. writing for a journal. So we want, you know, we might not be as plain language as we think we should, because we know that editors will look at prose that's too plain language and say, well, you're not serious. And so you have to have these like flowery, complicated sentences to seem legitimate. Versus writing for a public audience where you can't use all of that jargon because you'll lose people, mm-hmm. and it needs to be straightforward prose that's more plain language. Or when you're talking with your students, you have to keep their attention and you have to make these concepts make sense to them. And so it's just another exercise in changing what you've done to match what the job ad is asking mm-hmm. for. And then the person who's going to be reading it, to make it legible to them. And to give yourself legitimacy if this is your first industry role.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's all about presenting a slightly different face to mm-hmm. whoever it is you happen to be, you know, trying to work with. Mm-hmm. And it's always you. It's just a slightly different version of you.
Yeah, it's like a register or a language variety.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you're doing just a little bit of code switching. It's mm-hmm. fine. It's totally fine. Still you.
Yep.
So, In terms of your career, you've moved from job to job, like following different paths. Mm-hmm. Were there things that prompted you to switch jobs, particularly like something opened up, there was an opportunity? Mm-hmm. Like, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. There's always a reason why I switched. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, my first role in industry was a contract, and I was presented with a full-time opportunity with benefits and an increased salary. So I moved. And then I moved to my next role, which was a consulting role, because I did not like logistics very much. It was not very fulfilling. It was not an ideal work environment for me. So I made the switch to consulting, and I did that for about 5 years. And then I decided, you know, I don't know that I want to be a consultant anymore. I've done mm-hmm. that. It's mm-hmm. interesting. I like the autonomy. I like all of that, but I want to see more of the start to finish project life cycle, which you don't really get as a consultant. Like, you come in and you do the work, and then you give them the deliverables, and then you go away because your contract is over. Mm-hmm. And then you never really know what happened to the work once you've handed it over.
Exactly.
Which, you know, there's good things about that. And, you know, but I wanted to try something else. So that's when I went to an in-house role at Calendly, where I was able to see that end-to-end project lifecycle and see what happened once something was launched and be a part of a team and eventually lead a team. And then I moved to Android because I was basically headhunted by the manager of that mm-hmm. team, the emoji and expression team, because she specifically wanted a sociolinguist with UX research experience. And I was that weird unicorn that she wanted. And then, unfortunately, I did not make the choice to leave Android. I was laid off. And so, you know, there's a bunch of different reasons why I changed jobs. Some of them were, you know, my own agency, and some of them were business mm-hmm. decisions.
Yep. Normal. Extremely normal.
Yep.
And how did you come to work at New Public?
That's kind of funny. So I was a second place finalist for a role somewhere else. And the hiring manager was like, I'm going on parental leave. And when I come back, I'd really like to have you join the team because I have plans to expand it. But then her entire team was laid off a few months later. And as I was reaching out to her to say, I'm so sorry, you know, I've been in the laid off boat. If I can be of support, then, you know, I'd love to do so. As I was writing that message, she was writing to me and saying, hey, there's this role at New Public that I think you would be absolutely perfect for since I can't hire you. So I didn't know anybody there. I cold applied for the job and here I am.
Wow. Oh, that's great. Just to pop in with a comment.
Yeah.
The kind of thing that you were just saying there about reaching out to somebody in your network just to say, hey, man, I heard you got laid off. That's really terrible. Sorry. That's networking, right? That even doing things like that on LinkedIn, when somebody publishes an article that you think is really good saying, hey, I read this thing that you wrote. That was super cool. That's networking. Like that kind of reciprocal, I saw a thing you did, it was cool, or I heard that this bad thing happened to you and I'm really sorry about it. That all counts as networking. It's just kind of being social and human with people, and you're at a distance because, you know, you're not physically seeing them, but all of that stuff counts. And it feels really nice when it is reciprocal, and most people will do that. And even just leaving a like or whatever on something that they've done is the way to do it. And it can be hard because I've had many conversations with graduate students, especially, who are very new to LinkedIn, and they're like, ew. And I know, ew, but it's what you need to do. Unfortunately, LinkedIn is the platform where all this stuff happens. And you just have to suck it up and do it. And as long as you curate it really carefully and you use it the way it's supposed to be used, and you don't, it's like if you use Facebook or something, like, don't open it up for the stuff that they're going to suggest to you.
Yeah.
Just look at the people, follow the people that you follow. Don't let it suggest stuff to you, because that way lies madness.
Yeah.
You just only want to look at the stuff for the people that you actually know. And it can be okay.
Totally.
And interact with the people that you know, and give them a little bit of your goodness, and they'll give it right back to you. It's
absolutely. It's
okay. Yeah.
I know that a lot of folks think that networking is icky and it feels extractive, but it's not. I mean, I always tell people who are like, you know, how do I transition from academia to industry of any kind? And it's like, you can reach out to people and ask them about their job and ask them about what they love about their job and what do they do on a day-to-day basis. That's expected. That's what we do. That's what professionals do. And I think that in my experience in particular, I found people to be so open and so generous with their time.
Definitely.
And it's because someone did it for them before. People are willing to do that and make the effort because someone did it for them. And so it's like this ongoing, like, pay it forward kind of situation.
Absolutely.
And it's about, like, making authentic connections with people. Like, I don't keep up with everybody that I've networked with in the past because, you know, like, we either didn't click in that way, or, you know, it just, they moved in a different direction that is not aligned with my goals, or, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with letting a connection go cool. It's about, like, finding your people and then strengthening those bonds, like people who are in areas where you want to be, people who are doing work that you find interesting and you want to keep up with them. And, you know, some of those folks will turn into, like, genuine friends, and some of them won't, and that's okay. It's not, I understand it feels gross at first, but it's not, it's expected, and it's what people do.
Yeah. And that is all of the stuff that you said, absolutely true. And I think as academics, I don't know, maybe there's something in there that people have been told, or they see it from the outside, and it's like LinkedIn, fake friends. It's, you know, it feels very, there's another word that I'm searching for. I can't think of it. You know, it's like exchange based or something.
Yeah.
And it can be, I mean, you can treat it that way. And certainly there's a lot of garbage on LinkedIn that's, you know, people performatively posting all this nonsense about how successful they are trying to sell their MLM products or whatever. But there's a whole part of it that people really do use for developing their own little communities. And you can do that, and it will help you find jobs and stay in touch with people that you want to stay in touch with. So it is absolutely worth it to do that. And further, as I have said before, I mean, there's a whole community of linguists who really stick together and will refer work to each other and will, you know, just be a community of linguists, because the linguists who are in industry is still small, relatively speaking, but growing all the time. And I think we all have each other's backs because we all want to see more linguists in industry.
Oh, totally. If someone connects with me on LinkedIn and they don't have a message, because I know that you run out of ability to send messages when you're on the free version of LinkedIn, but they have linguists in their profile or whatever, I accept it.
Yeah.
Usually, because I'm like, yes, okay. But if it's just some random person with, you know, very little detail, or, you know, they don't send me a note, I usually am like, I don't know why you want to connect with me.
Yeah. Yep. So that's the message for all you Ling grad students out there. Start early. Like, do this before you graduate.
Oh, totally.
Just start building, because you're going to need it.
There are internship opportunities for folks who are still in school. So it's always good to start early.
So now that we've given you $10,000 worth of free advice about what to do. So you're working at a nonprofit right now. It sounds like it's a cool opportunity for you. Does this feel like a place where you want to be for a while? Like, do you have other ambitions? Are there other things that you want to be doing, or do you have side gigs that you're doing at the same time?
Oh gosh, startup means I don't have time for side gigs. Startups are very chaotic sometimes, and because it's a really small team, we don't have enough people to do all the work that is needed. So I just don't have the energy for that. But I love my team. So I just, you know, the job market in user experience, in particular tech in general, is not great right now. In December of 2025, it hasn't been great for a few years. The layoffs used to mean that your business was struggling. And now it seems like leadership uses layoffs to boost stock prices. I've stopped counting on any particular job as being someplace I will be for sure. Whereas, you know, maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I'd be like, yeah, I'm gonna be here for 5 years, I'm gonna be here for, you know, whatever. Would I like to stay? You know, can I see the future? No. Funding is volatile, and so I don't know where I'll be in a year or two, honestly.
Yeah. You've done a lot of speaking and workshops. Is that something you want to get back to?
I do enjoy that. I've been kind of selective about where I put my energy. Like I said, there's not enough hours in a day to do everything that I would love to do. But I've been doing some speaking. I've been doing some writing. I'm writing an article right now for a UX blog that I hope will come out early next year. So there's some stuff that I'm doing on the side.
Cool. Very, very cool.
Yeah.
Just as we're wrapping up here, you have had so much great advice for people who are starting to enter the job market, or people who are in the job market, in fact, and, you know, considering what their next steps might be. Is it okay if I put your LinkedIn link in the show notes in case people want to contact you, maybe for an informational interview or to get some more information from you?
Yeah, that would be fine. With the caveat that around this time of year, January, December, I don't have a ton of extra bandwidth, but I'm always happy to answer emails via LinkedIn messaging or email or whatever. So I'm happy to do that. I might not have the bandwidth to do an interview, but I'm happy to respond to questions.
Okay, that sounds awesome. Great. Well, I will put that in the show notes along with some links to various things that you've done so people can read more about you. But this has been delightful. Thank you so much for giving me the time to talk with you today. And I think all the listeners will have learned a lot from your experience.
Well, thank you for so much for having me. And if I may add one final thing about entering into the tech job market right now, I just want to say it can be really discouraging because it's kind of mirroring the academic job market a little bit right now, especially in UX research. There's just a lot of the roles that are available are for senior level people. And so it can be really hard for folks to make that transition right now. So what worked for me in 2015 may not work for you in 2025, 2026, but that doesn't mean that it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. I just temper my expectations and lean really hard on building those relationships and having, you know, multiple options of things that sound interesting to you. So, you know, not just UX research, but maybe look at like think tanks or other areas where your skills could be needed. But just wanted to add that it's really, really hard right now. Don't get discouraged, but also, you know, the reality is that it's hard at the moment. But yeah, it'll change, I think.
I was just going to say that. I think next year, 2026, is just a great big question mark. Like nobody knows what next year is going to look like. There's a lot of talk about what happens when the AI bubble bursts, which it probably will. And the layoffs seem unsustainable because so many companies are supposedly, you know, they're cutting, as you say, they're just cutting things to boost stock prices. Mm-hmm. But like the work has to get done.
It does.
And it's not getting done. And they're going to have to rehire some people to do some of the work. And I don't know. It just, the way things are going seems completely madly unsustainable. And so it's going to have to change at some point. And I don't know what that's going to look like.
Yeah, me either. But I agree with you. I mean, I was talking with my mom, like I was saying, she was in tech for a long time, 30, 40 years. And she said that this downturn that we're seeing in the last 4 or 5 years is the worst she's ever experienced. Yeah. But she said, I always see it rebound. And they will realize that, like you just said, the work needs to get done and it's not getting done. So what that looks like, we'll see. But I do think there's a lot of opportunity for linguists out there. That's why I think what your point of starting now while you're still in school is so, so important. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Don't wait until you're desperate for income to start doing this work. Do it now. Start now. Because when things turn around, I think you'll be in a better position.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Great. All right. Well, on that happy note. Oh, thanks again for spending time. We know that was good. Like, you know, things will change. It always does. It always does. Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held 2 online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.